You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The issue of women's rights in the Middle East has become something of a flashpoint in recent years, but the heated arguments often obscure progress that's being made on the individual level. In her new book, Paradise Beneath Her Feet, How Women Are Transforming the Middle East, Isabel Coleman looks into that growing Islamic feminist movement. She's the director of the Women in Foreign Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations, and she's also a senior fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy. Her book is published by Random House, and I'm very pleased that it brings her to our show today. Hello.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Now, are we talking about a real movement here, a feminist movement?
Well, I think it depends on the country. I think in some countries you have a very active women's movement. I mean, Iran has a very active women's movement. Americans have seen Iranian women on the streets and demonstrating. But I would argue that that's the most evolved and most advanced women's movement in the region. In other countries, I don't think we can talk about a movement within those countries yet.
Well, would we see similarities between the women's movement that we're discussing here and women's movements in, or women's rights movements in other parts of the world?
Well, yeah, I think that the similarities are that women have had greater consciousness, and you see women now moving into fields where women's issues are discussed more. You have more women journalists, more women's issues being dealt with in the media. And if you look back at women's movements in other countries, the growth of sort of women's magazines and women's journals helped that consciousness raising along.
Is the women's movement label something that all of the women that you profile would embrace?
Women's movement, I think, is something that many of them would embrace. Feminism is not something they would embrace. It's a concept that for them has many negative connotations, is really imbued, is really loaded with a lot of things that are viewed negatively in that part of the world. Westernism, materialism, colonialism, communism in some cases. So I think many people would reject the term feminism, but a women's movement, I think, is gaining adherence by the day.
But can we use the word feminism in this context, in this discussion?
I do in my book.
Is Islamic feminism part of the strain of more moderate or progressive Islam, or are there conservative Muslims who also support more rights for women?
There are certainly people who we would say are conservative Muslims who are nevertheless embracing more rights for women, and undoubtedly there are many moderate and progressive Muslims who actively advocate for more rights for women. But even among conservative Muslims, you're now seeing in some cases a begrudging, but in others not so begrudging, tolerance or even support for greater rights for women.
Although there are women who are resisting. There was an article in the Times recently about a woman named Rauha Yousef who became disturbed because of campaigns for greater personal freedoms for women, women asking for the right to drive in Saudi Arabia, to choose whether to wear a veil, to take a job without a male relative's permission, to use the internet to collect signatures and organize meetings. And then the last straw, she said, was reports that a female activist in Saudi Arabia's eastern province had been to the border with Bahrain, demanding to cross using only her passport. And this woman said, we should be trusting our protectors, the men.
I know it seems very strange for us to hear of women taking these types of positions. And there are women who advocate against these, an expansion of what we think of as just normal freedoms, frankly. But I think it's important to remember that throughout the ages, there have been women who have fought against women's rights. You know, going back to the anti-suffrage movement in America, there were many women who were involved in that anti-suffrage
movement.
Phyllis
Schlafly was opposed to the ERA.
Absolutely.
Among others. So
indeed.
She would not be surprised by this woman's campaign. My guardian knows what's best for me.
Indeed. You know, there is this idea that women's rights somehow undermine the family, undermine culture, tradition, and when it's pitched in those terms, women will take positions that are against those perceived undermining of the traditions and values, particularly when it relates to the family.
many Muslim scholars have pointed out that the religion itself doesn't curtail women's rights. Do Islamic feminists base their arguments on the Quran the way their conservative opponents do?
Well, that is the definition that I'm using of Islamic feminism, is that they're seeing within the Quran these rights for women. And so they're not appealing necessarily to universal or humanist principles of human rights. Some of them do, but they also are appealing to the Quran because they are trying to operate in very conservative societies where the touchstone for the average person is the Quran. And so they deem it very important to have that legitimacy and that credibility on their side. So they do appeal to the Quran and promote those more progressive arguments, just as you said.
You say there are three crucial elements of women's empowerment. Are they just relevant to the Muslim world as far as what you're discussing, or are they relevant to women everywhere?
I think they're relevant to women everywhere. I think it's political voice, it's economic access, and education. And these three things are, in my mind, sort of three legs of a stool relevant to women around the world.
So it's no coincidence that Muhammad Yunus's Grameen Bank lends predominantly to women?
It is no coincidence, indeed. I mean, one of the things that Muhammad Yunus found is that when you give, you know, small loans to women, that they use it in many ways more effectively than men, and that the social positive social repercussions of that are greater, frankly, than lending to men.
My guess is Isabel Coleman, her book Paradise Beneath Her Feet, How Women Are Transforming the Middle East. It's published by Random House. Why is the empowerment of women not just a political issue for much of the Muslim world?
Well, it's certainly a political issue. It's certainly a social and cultural and human rights issue, but it's also, frankly, a very important economic issue. And I think there are more and more countries realizing that when they disempower and disinvest in half their population, that they are cutting themselves off from future global prosperity and global prosperity today.
Well, some of these countries involved are among the world's poorest.
Again, no coincidence there. I would argue that a country like Saudi, which is among the wealthiest nations in the world, they are one of the few that can afford their incredibly oppressive practices to women. But other countries cannot afford that.
Well, do the local governments realize that?
Indeed, they do, increasingly. And even in Saudi Arabia, there are people who are promoting and pushing for greater women's rights on economic grounds. You know, I was really taken with, and I quote in my book, one of the members of the Saudi Shura Council, their, you know, quasi-parliament. I think it's too grandiose to call it a parliament, but it's an advisory council to the king. Who has stood up and argued publicly in the Shura Council for women's right to drive because, frankly, importing labor to drive women around is just too expensive. They're spending $4 billion a year to hire Pakistani drivers and sending all that money back to Pakistan in remittances. So they're appealing on economic grounds, even in a country like Saudi Arabia.
Is the debate different in the more secular countries of the Muslim world, Egypt, Tunisia, Turkey, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon?
The debate is different in that there, in the more secular countries, there have been secular laws that have promoted and protected women's rights. But it's similar in that those laws come under pressure. They come under pushback from powerful Islamist groups who want to erode those laws or overturn them on religious grounds. And so it's similar in that people who are working to protect those rights often have to marshal not only civil law and secular law, but looking increasingly at Islamic justifications for doing it.
Is the situation different in Southeast Asia? Because we have seen in Bangladesh and in Pakistan women who have become prime ministers. And Indonesia as well. Indonesia, you say, has become the home to some of the best Islamic feminist organizations.
It's different in some respects, but in others, again, you have across the Muslim majority world, you do have the powerful influence of Islamist groups and Islamist parties in Pakistan, in Indonesia, that have sought to erode women's rights. I mean, Pakistan was really more of a secular country, and before Zia-ul-Huq decided to Islamize it. And that process of Islamizing Pakistan really directly affected women's rights. He pushed forward some very onerous laws towards women, in particular the Hudud laws, on religious grounds that eroded rights for women in that country. And it is a similar process that you see even in conservative Arab countries.
Well, when women rise to levels of power in those countries, is that really more of a dynastic thing than – because in all cases, the women who have been the leaders of Bangladesh and Pakistan and Indonesia have been the daughters of men who have played major roles in the histories of the country.
There's certainly truth to that. On the other hand, you know, I think you've seen a lot of progression on democracy in Indonesia, for example. And you have many women leaders in the country who are coming up through the ranks and projecting their political voice. I think that process is also proceeding somewhat in Bangladesh, less so in Pakistan. Pakistan is really a troubled country in many respects.
So women don't get political power on the local level in most countries?
Well, countries are working on increasing women's political voice at the local level and using quotas to do so. Pakistan is one of them. And in fact, President Musharraf and some of his predecessors, but he also, you know, worked to expand these quotas for women at the local level as a way of including women's voices and, you know, he often said more moderate voices at that local level.
We talked today about political Islam. Hasn't Islam always been kind of a political religion in a way? There's been less separation of church and state in Islam than there have been in many other religions?
Well, modern, yes. I mean, that has been true for if you compare Islam today to modern Christianity. But I think if you go back several centuries, Christianity and the political sphere were completely right. Melded together.
King Henry VIII could change
Absolutely.
The religion, you know, of England.
And Constantine and others, you know, it was political power and religious power were very much meshed. We've had a reformation in the West. We've had a period of centuries of growing secularism and that separation of church and state that has not happened in most of the Muslim world. I mean, it certainly happened in some Muslim countries, but not in others. Although there are many Islamic scholars and theologians who argue about this point. What is the role of the mosque and in the state?
Well, since you said earlier that the Quran doesn't really call for repression of women, then where does this come from? Is this a political thing?
Well, you were saying that scholars say that. There are many Islamic scholars who say that.
You can read, as in all holy works, you can read a lot of different things into
the text. I would say
that's
true. I think that you could find some, you can certainly pick out some oppressive passages in any holy work towards different groups, including women. And undoubtedly, there are passages in the Quran that are difficult for women, undoubtedly. I mean, there's some very harsh and repressive passages in the Quran. But what there are Islamic scholars who focus on the tenor of the early Quran and early Islam as being progressive for women, and that's what they promote.
My guest is Isabel Coleman, a senior fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, where she also directs the Council's Women and Foreign Policy Program. Her book, Paradise Beneath Her Feet, How Women Are Transforming the Middle East, is published by Random House, and we will continue our conversation after this. My guest is Isabel Coleman, her book Paradise Beneath Her Feet, How Women Are Transforming the Middle East. It is published by Random House. Let's talk about Iran, because Iran is one of those flashpoint countries. It had a vice president who was a woman at one point, although she was also part of the wasn't she one of the students involved in the takeover of the American embassy?
She was the spokesperson for the students.
So what happened?
You know, her story is one that I describe in my book. You know, she was like many of her fellow revolutionaries, very idealistic. She really approached the revolution more from a leftist perspective, but was enthralled with this idea of Khomeini and social justice and what it would do. And she was nicknamed Tehran Mary because she was she'd grown up in the Philadelphia area and spoke fluent English with a slight American accent, and proudly wore her chador on newscasts and defended the takeover of the embassy and the hostage crisis and defended the regime. But along the way, you know, she became resentful of the regime, and in particular of its treatment with women, and has become more outspoken for reform and change, as many of her compatriots have.
Well, in speaking to people from Iran and from other countries in the area, much as hypocrisy is a word that often comes up, people seem to live two lives. The women wear protective garb, and at the same time, sometimes what's underneath it isn't always something that might be acceptable to the conservatives. They live double lives. I've seen Iranian films where women walk around without headscarves, and every time they think they're going to come into a situation where they'll be in contact with men or people who might object, they put the scarves back on.
Well, hypocrisy is rife throughout the region. It's unfortunately rife around the world, but I'm always taken aback by the levels of hypocrisy of people putting themselves out as so conservative and pious in a way in some of these countries and living, as you said, quite a double life.
For many, the symbol of the protests that followed the 2009 elections in Iran was the shooting death of a woman named Neda. Do you think that the West was more surprised that a woman would be the victim of that kind of political violence than the people of Iran were?
Well, I certainly wasn't surprised. You know, so many of the women activists that I profile in my book have continued their activism with such tremendous personal courage, even as their movements and their groups have been coming under increasing pressure. So many of them have been thrown in prison. I think that the idea of a woman being the face of the movement is something many Iranians are proud of, and it's not a surprise for them. I mean, there has been this growing resistance coming from women who are most burdened and on a day-to-day basis by the increasingly silly restrictions of the regime on the way that they try to live their life.
What's the general social reaction to women who gain some economic independence in these different countries? I'm sure it's different in each country.
Oh, it's very different, yeah.
But is there general acceptance in some countries of a woman becoming independently wealthy?
Yeah, I mean, it really is different country by country. In Iran, you know, women work in most aspects of the economy today. You know, I have seen female women working on construction sites in Tehran. I had two female taxi drivers during my last visit to Tehran, and I've never actually just once in 15 years of living in New York have I had a female taxi driver. So you do see women in sort of all aspects of the economy there. And in some of the Gulf states, you have some very prominent, very successful businesswomen. Even in Saudi, you have some very successful businesswomen. In a country like Afghanistan, deeply conservative, very, very traditional and patriarchal, I think it's much more unusual to see successful businesswomen, but you see them moving out into the economy even there.
What about a country like Syria, which is
a more secular country, and you've certainly had women in all the professions in Syria, doctors, lawyers, judges, and in the business sphere, too.
Have women been able to move into places of religious authority?
Well, that's an interesting new development that I see, and I chronicle a little bit in the book, that women are beginning to move into the production of religion and as scholars and as religious leaders. There are a number of programs that various governments have adopted, one in Morocco to train women as preachers who can do everything that the men can do except lead the Friday prayer. And that program in the Morshidat program in Morocco is one which the government has promoted as a way of not only empowering women, but explicitly tempering extremism in their own society, the idea that having women as these religiously sanctioned social workers, in effect, in local communities, local poor, rural and urban communities, will in some way help the young angry men in their societies move away from extremism.
In the second part of your book, you focus on five countries. Why did you choose Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, and Saudi Arabia? Are they the countries that are most representative, or the one where situation is most precarious?
Well, I focus on those countries for a couple of reasons. One is that they are very strategic countries that I think those in the West would be most interested in on what's going on in those countries. They represent the largest populations. We've got two active wars going on, one in Iraq, one in Afghanistan. They're a big oil producer, Saudi and Iran and Iraq, all three. And they're so from a importance perspective, they're all strategic. The other thing is that they are all in some way or another, versions of a theocracy. They are not secular countries. And what I'm writing about is how women are trying to navigate these societies. Saudi is a theocracy outright. Iran is a theocracy outright. Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan all have elements of theocracy in that they have elevated Sharia to very high levels in their constitution. So even though Iraq and Afghanistan, their constitutions speak about equal rights and freedom and all sorts of things, they also clearly say no rule can contradict Sharia.
In the two countries that have U.S.-led occupations, we're seeing different movements for women. In Iraq, I would think things have gotten more restrictive, and Afghanistan, they freed up a bit.
Well, it's all relative. So from Iraq, they've gotten more restrictive. From what was one of the more advanced, progressive, and secular environments in the region for women going back to the 1970s and 80s. In Afghanistan, you had arguably the least restrictive and most hostile environment for women. So it has been upwards since the time of the Taliban. But again, it's all relative.
Well, the Taliban would beat women for wearing a head to, for not wearing a head to toe burqa, for not having a male guardian in public, and even for laughing. Were conservatives in Afghanistan always so hostile to the idea of educating women and allowing women to even laugh in public?
You know, in the book, I talk a little bit about the history of Afghanistan. And in the 1920s, it was led by a young, dynamic, daring, some might say overly intrepid king, King Amanullah, who with his wife, young and beautiful Queen Saraya, took a trip to the West, and they went to visit Great Britain. They were given a Rolls Royce, which they drove back across Central Asia to Afghanistan. And Saraya, that King Amanullah was determined to modernize his country and went down this path. And one attempt he made was to have his wife unveil, and it was really the final straw that undid him. There were so many tribal forces that were absolutely horrified by this that they overthrew him, and that was the end of him. But that's a long way of saying there have been some reformers throughout this country's history, but also some deeply entrenched conservative, tribal, patriarchal leaders who've worked against it.
How much of this is a resistance to Western influence? For example, I think the resistance got strongest after the Soviets got really involved in Afghanistan. And right now we're seeing a certain amount of resistance because of the United States' position in Afghanistan.
Well, I think that on this issue of women's rights, it has been complicated by the position by many of the either political Islamists or these in Afghanistan, you know, tribal leaders who do view it in terms of resistance to an alien or Western culture, which is why women in trying to promote their rights are trying to do it within this Islamic framework to find more local authenticity for their efforts to prevent that backlash or to reduce that backlash.
My guest is Isabel Coleman. Her book, Paradise Beneath Her Feet, How Women Are Transforming the Middle East, is published by Random House. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, in Afghanistan, Greg Mortensen and some others have focused on the education of girls, but at times the Taliban has targeted girls' schools in Afghanistan. Are they trying to send a message to families about sending their daughters to school?
I think they're primarily trying to send a message to the West. You know, you bring your schools here, you build them, and we're going to build them, burn them down and attack them. But, you know, what's remarkable is these Afghan families who rebuild the schools and send their daughters back. And the polls all show that over time, support for girls' education has not declined in that country.
And individual mullahs have decided to allow local people to send their girls to the school, even though the Taliban remains a threat.
Absolutely. There are many local leaders and local religious leaders, too, who see it as an Islamic injunction that you must teach your daughters to read, that it is that the Taliban is really working against Islam, not for it.
One person you spoke to there asked that America not abandon Afghanistan. Do you have the sense that the Taliban could put their repressive policies back in place pretty quickly if and easily as well if they were to once again be incorporated into the political framework of Afghanistan?
I think they'll certainly try, but I don't think that they'll be able to turn the clock back to the 1990s in that country. I think that you've had too many people exposed through the spread. I mean, every time I go to Afghanistan, more internet cafes, more people with cell phones, more people watching television. Afghan Star, which is sort of like an American Idol type show, is hugely popular in Afghanistan. They'll do their best to turn all of that back, to take women off the air, to take women off the radio. But I think that people will resist it and fight against that, frankly. As I said, you know, the polls show that the Taliban's deeply unpopular and that things like girls' education, 85% of the population supports it.
Throughout the book, you describe individual women who've been able to get political power or economic freedom or an education. Do you feel that that's an underreported story in the West?
Well, I do. I feel that people don't understand how these societies are changing and how quickly they're changing in some respects. You know, a country like Saudi Arabia, which frankly is very medieval in many of its practices today, only started educating girls in the 1960s. It was the first time they even allowed girls to go to school. And now, two generations later, you have a majority of college graduates in Saudi are women, 60%. So I think more changes are going to follow from this inevitably.
On the other hand, we've seen in some of the secular countries attempts to for example, in Turkey, they banned the fez, but right now there's a movement for more and more women to wear headscarves, and we've seen that in Egypt and elsewhere, which would suggest that top-down change isn't necessarily going to happen in those countries.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big themes of my book is that these top-down changes, they do lead to backlash, and what you see in these countries where women in Turkey and in Egypt and in other countries around the region where women are wearing the headscarf in much greater numbers than they did in the past is as much a statement of political opposition to these top-down authoritarian leaders. In Turkey, I've seen some recent polls showing that the incidence of wearing the headscarf has peaked and even declined in some areas because now you have Islamists in power. And so it's not quite as politically salient to be wearing the headscarf in terms of opposition to that government.
On the other hand, then you have the French Parliament about to vote this week on banning headscarves and other European countries engaged in similar kinds of legislation. And I'm wondering how that's playing out among Islamic feminists.
Well, the banning of the debate in France right now is very much around the niqab, which is the full face covering, not just the wearing of a headscarf. And the niqab is a very controversial symbol for a variety of reasons. One is that it completely covers your identity, so there are security issues there. The other thing is that it's debated within Islam over whether it's Islamic. And there are many Islamic scholars who say that the wearing of the niqab is anti-Islamic. You've had Grand Sheikh Al-Tantawi at Al-Azhar, who was one of the, you know, heads of the of a great center of Islamic learning, come out and say that the niqab is anti-Islamic.
Do you think that when people in the West support women who are gaining an economic and political foothold, they're actually sometimes having a negative effect because there's resistance to any kind of Western hegemony in these countries?
Well, you know, I used to be very reluctant or cautious about advocating for Western engagement or help on these issues. You know, I really was concerned that it could undermine these movements. But now, having written this book, I realize that the women that I write about are very sophisticated people, and they understand their own circumstances better than anybody, and they are the best to calculate whether that outstretched hand from the West is going to hurt or help them more. And some of them do figure that it's going to hurt them more, and they don't take it. Certainly in Iran today, contact with the West has been not a positive thing for many of these groups, and they go to extreme lengths to really make sure that they're viewed independently within Iran, that they're not some tool of the West. But other countries that I've written about, other women and women's groups, they do take support from the West, and that support is very critical to them, both technical support, financial support, moral support. It's very important to the fragile movement that they're trying to build and sustain.
Isabel Coleman is a senior fellow for U.S. Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, where she also directs the Council's Women and Foreign Policy Program. Her writing has appeared in publications like Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, Financial Times, the International Herald Tribune, USA Today, the Christian Science Monitor, and now there's a book called Paradise Beneath Her Feet, How Women Are Transforming the Middle East. It's published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.